Chapter 6. Abu Ja'far At-Tabari, Sunni historian and Quranic exegete, 913 CE. Abu Ja'far Muhammad ibn Jarir At-Tabari, hereafter Tabari, was a Persian born in the mid-9th century in what is today northern Iran. Though he did not die until 923 CE, he had already lived a long, productive life at the dawn of the 4th Muslim century. He was perhaps 75 years old when the Muslim calendar, which is lunar and not solar, and begins with the Prophet Muhammad's flight, Hijra, from Mecca to Medina, turned to a new century in 913 CE. Like other devout non-Arab Muslims who aspired to be scholars, he had mastered Arabic as a second language. He knew Arabic, but he did not think like his Arab co-religionists. He approached the entire period of Muslim history not as an Arab linked to Western Arabia, the Prophet's birthplace, but as a Persian linked to Iran and to Mesopotamia, regions adjacent to Arabia, and often in competition with it for local prestige among Muslims. Tabari was aware that learning meant mastery of skills in rhetoric, grammar, syntax, and eloquence. It also meant acknowledging the weight of the Muslim past, the figures who had been linked to the Prophet Muhammad and who were repositories of his message. First were the Quran reciters. They had preserved the book as a living oral source. Custodians of revelation, they made a book of signs their primary focus. In Tabari's era, there were 7, or perhaps 10, or even 14 different forms of both reading and reciting the Quranic text. Beyond reciting the Quran and delighting in Arabic verse, Muslim scholars also needed to synthesize the streams of revelation and prophetic experience into systems of virtue, codes of conduct that could guide the emerging Muslim community. The people who did this were known as jurists. 2 of them Tabari especially admired. One was Shafi'i, who had died 100 years earlier. Shafi'i had lived and written on the cusp of the 3rd century of the Muslim era. He died in 820 CE, corresponding to 204 AH. He had been devoted to interpreting the Quran through the example of the Prophet, so much so that he had argued that the two sources of truth could not be in conflict. What the Quran announced, the Prophet had lived. What he lived complemented and completed what the Quran announced. There could be no disagreement, much less conflict, between the message and the messenger. Another jurist, contemporary with Tabari, was Ahmad ibn Hanbal. Tabari admired Ibn Hanbal, but less for his juridical insight than for his prodigious command of reports about the Prophet. The helter-skelter mass of accounts that all claimed to be linked to the Prophet, but depended on honorable, honest transmitters for the authenticity of their content. Sharing with Shafi'i the view that the Prophet's life and words completed the message of the Quran, Tabari followed Ibn Hanbal to Baghdad, the capital of the vast Islamic empire. There Tabari found some traditions or prophetic tributes, but he also found that most of the links to pronouncements by or about the Prophet were outside Iraq. He traveled to Syria, to Egypt, to other towns in Iraq in order to gather material about the prophetic legacy. He confirmed what he could, but he also rejected much of what he heard as spurious. At the same time, he explored all aspects of the Islamic past. He engaged in contests for reciting Arabic poetry, drawing on verses that predated the rise of Islam. He discussed issues of Quran recitation. Which forms were preferred? In which regions were they preferred, and by whom? Tabari made his life's work the endeavor to summarize all that was known and all that he could discover about interpretations of a book of signs. He also wrote a vast history of the world, which some would argue has been as influential as his study of the Quran. If he had only written about the Quran, he would still have been one of the most important Muslim scholars of all time. His body of work contained no less than 30 books and fills 12 volumes in a recent printed edition. Tabari surveyed all the work of his predecessors, aiming not so much to provide an order for the signs as to enumerate and evaluate all possible approaches to them. For Tabari, it was futile to try to imagine how the Prophet Muhammad received the stream of light from beyond. The Quran was a many-splendored entity. It was a poem, a prayer book, a song, and also a code of laws. It was a poem because of its lyrical style and evocative words, but it was a poem unlike any other poem. The Quran was a prayer book because all Muslims used it for ritual prayer, salat, but also for invocatory prayer, dua. Its recitation was musical, but not like other songs. It conveyed meaning through sound. The Quran also had become a code of laws, in no small part due to the skill of devout Muslim jurists such as Shafi'i and Ibn Hanbal. The Quran for Tabari was, above all, a further stage of revelation that had already been reflected in the Bible. The Quran, in his view, was the Bible multiplied, since it contained so many of the stories familiar to Jews and Christians, but with new accents. Much shorter than the Torah of Jews, the Quran is bigger than the Christian Gospels. Although Muhammad produced no miracle, yet the Quran was a divine miracle that he transmitted. Time and again, the task of the interpreter was to demonstrate how the revelations given to Muhammad fulfilled earlier prophecies, while also surpassing them in scope, accuracy, and insight. One of the first instances of Tabari's distinctive approach appears in his interpretation of the opening chapter. The final verses read, "Guide us to the path of true direction, the path of those whom you favor, not of those who cause you anger, nor of those who took to the path of deviation." Chapter 1, verse 6 through 7. In imitation of Socratic dialogue, he has an anonymous questioner ask him his opinion about the party who caused anger and the party who took to the path of deviation. Tabari responds, "Those who cause divine anger are those whom God describes in his revelation as those whom God cursed and at whom God was wrathful, and of whom God made apes and swine, and who worshipped idols. That is the worse, in actuality, and further astray from the right way." Chapter 5, verse 60. In other words, Tabari interpreted the Quran in terms set by the Quran. Looking at the opening chapter, the seven verses that became the prototype for all revelations in a book of signs were interpreted by Tabari by looking at a subsequent chapter, the table, where the same Arabic words were used for wrath and straying. In this second case, it seems to be the Jews who suffered both God's anger and lost their way or went astray. Tabari then confirms the identity of this group by citing numerous pages from traditions of the Prophet Muhammad, the Hadith, that name the Jews as those with whom God is indignant. Later, he notes that the second half of the declamation could also refer to a second group. While it might seem that those with whom God is angry were also the same as those who had gone astray, there could in fact be another group, one differentiated and marked by having gone astray. These could be Christians, as seems apparent later in the chapter of the table when God commands, "People of the book, do not exceed the bounds of truth in your religion, and follow not the whims of a people who went astray before, and led many astray, and now again have gone astray from the right way." Chapter 5, verse 77. To one who reads Tabari's commentary on the final verses of the opening chapter, and stops here, it would seem that he is openly anti-Jewish and anti-Christian, parading Islam as the only true religion at the expense of its two predecessors, Judaism and Christianity. Yet an openly polemical reading of his commentary is qualified by what follows. In every section of his commentary, Tabari quotes commentaries that others before him have offered, and summarizes their views before giving his own. It is not until the end that Tabari suggests what might be the real meaning of particular verses. Tabari begins with a rhetorical query. Why has the Almighty made such a long delivery in the very first chapter? Didn't the initial verses, lauding God as compassion and compassionate, as Lord of all creation, as master of the day of determination, didn't those two verses suffice? What more wisdom is there, asks Tabari, in the five other verses, apart from that which is already contained in the first two? That rhetorical question then allows Tabari to restate the divine intent. It was, above all, to confirm the divine origin of the Quran. Its form matches its content. Even as it affirms previous scriptures, a book of signs is distinguished from previous scriptures by its marvelous order, its extraordinary coherence, and the unique pattern of its composition. Though imitators are legion, they are all defeated in trying to equal it. Orators cannot match the orderly arrangement of even its shortest chapters. Rhetoricians exhaust themselves trying to describe the form of even a part of it. Poets are baffled and defeated by its internal sounds that exceed all rules of verse. As for intellectuals, they are the ones whose skills, in Tabari's view, are most pitiable in their approach to a book of signs. All they can do is submit and affirm that it comes from the Great One, the Vanquisher. It contains meanings not assembled in any other book brought down from heaven to earth. Through narrative, dialectics, and parables, it offers imperatives to act and imperatives to refrain from acting, passages that attract and passages that frighten. Uppermost in Tabari's mind is the ethical power of discourse. A book of signs, above all, demonstrates the divine intent through passages that attract and passages that frighten. And that intent is illustrated nowhere more clearly than in the last two verses of the opening chapter. They serve a general purpose not restricted to Jews and Christians. Through mentioning in it the exemplary retribution he brought down on those who disobeyed him, and the punishment which befell those who went against his command, his intent was to cause his servants to fear perpetrating acts of disobedience to him and exposing themselves to his anger. In other words, Jews and Christians were representative of all human beings, including Muslims, who might not comply with the divine will, and so fail to pursue the straight path. Tabari provides a more universal reading of not just the opening chapter, but the entire Quran. He focuses above all on seeing Muhammad as the final prophet, who is nothing less than the successor and confirmation of Abraham. It is the saga of the prophet Abraham that informs what happened to the prophet Muhammad. Abraham progressed from ignorance and innocence, chapter 6, verse 77 through 78, to uncertainty, chapter 2, verse 260, and finally to faith in the one God, full of compassion, ever compassionate. It was Abraham who marked the journey from ignorance to prophecy, idolatry to oneness. He became the recipient of a divine blessing for all humankind, and he made Arabia the place of his true descendants, those whose seed flowed from his concubine Hagar to her son Ishmael, and then to all the Arabs, including those of the tribe of Quraysh, into which the prophet Muhammad was born. And so, while the Quraysh in particular and Arabs in general were privileged by divine grace, grace was no more exclusively theirs than anger and punishment were the expected and probable outcome for all Jews and Christians. The divine favor had touched both Jews and Christians, as several Quranic passages attest. In the same vein, suggests Tabari, it also flowed not just to Arab Muslims, but also to Persians who joined the Muslim fold after the Arab conquest of Iraq and Iran. Although Tabari was a Persian and read the Quran in part as a Persian, he was also the product of his age. By the end of the 3rd century in the Hijri calendar, Islamic learning was no longer new. But it was also far from fixed as a form of observance and guidance for devout Muslims. Tabari seems to have harbored a sense of how the vast rivulets of scholarship that preceded him were turning into an ocean of interpretation that could confuse as well as inform. How does one provide a criterion for assessing the ocean of meaning within the noble Quran? Tabari thought it necessary to divide all the signs into 3 categories. There was one set of signs for which the Prophet Muhammad and he alone was the interpreter. Chapter 16, verses 44 and 64. Another set of verses were those for which God and God alone could be the interpreter, such as verses indicating the final hour of judgment, knowledge which even the Prophet did not know. Chapter 7, verse 187. And then there were the vast majority of verses, those that everyone who knew the Arabic language of the Quran could interpret. Tabari had titled his great work, The Comprehensive Exposition of the Interpretation of the Verses of the Quran. The word for interpretation in Arabic was tawil, literally going back to first principles, trying to explain the Quran through the Quran. For him, tawil seemed identical with another word, tafsir, that is, expositing the meaning of words, phrases, and passages from the Quran. In Tabari's mind, the two words flowed together like two tributaries of water. They were synonyms, if not homonyms, of the same enterprise. The value of looking at first principles is the benefit of seeing God, the Prophet, and the ordinary believer as joint participants in the Quran. Precisely because there are two human readers, there must also be two levels of interpretation. The Prophet interpreted the Quran throughout his life. Both his deeds and his words offer a reading of its message. But for the ordinary believer, it is necessary to distinguish between the signs, as not all have the same value. A book of signs contains signs whose meaning the reader, with the proper background, can readily decipher. Their meaning should be transparent. Tabari calls these clear signs, but there are others, the ones to which God alone knows the interpretation, that are ambiguous signs. It is a clever distinction, especially in what it does not say. It does not say that the clear signs have only one possible interpretation, only that the levels of interpretation should be clear to one who approaches them with the proper background and intent. Nor are the ambiguous signs excluded from any human interpretation. They include the mysterious letters that introduce some of the Quranic chapters, beginning with chapter 2, the chapter of the cow, which after the basmala has 3 letters, alif, lam, mim. By the time of Tabari, many Muslims had begun to consult the letters in chapter 2 and later chapters for auguries, a whole informal science of divination based on matching numbers with letters had emerged. Tabari condemned such interpretations of the ambiguous signs, but at the same time, since everything in the Quran has both a purpose and a meaning, Tabari argued that one can understand these ambiguous signs. It is simply that one must delay trying to understand them until one has mastered the clear signs. In other words, each interpreter must first make sense of those clear signs, with their explicit spiritual and moral roadmaps, before veering into the more dangerous terrain marked by ambiguous signs. Tabari's role as a Quran commentator was complicated by his own status as a Sunni Muslim. While he upheld the special virtue of Ali and all those linked to the Prophet's household, he was committed to the path of political succession that produced first the Umayyad, then the Abbasid Caliphate. The degree to which Tabari represents a Sunni rather than a Shiite approach to the Quran can be seen in his cautious use of the term tawil. As we have seen before, he makes tawil equivalent to the more frequent and familiar word tafsir. That may seem like a concession to Shiite sensibilities, but the category which Tabari highlights as ambiguous signs is more restricted for him than for his Shiite counterparts. It applies to the mysterious letters and a few other passages, but not to one quarter of the Quran, as Ali is alleged to have said it does. Nor does it extend to the many verses that Shiites claimed had a meaning reserved for the Prophet's household, especially for the Imams, the lineage of Shiite leaders, descended from Ali and Fatima, the Prophet's daughter. For Tabari, Abu Bakr and Umar, as well as Ali, had sound credentials to be legitimate heirs, and therefore successors to the Prophet Muhammad. Even Uthman could be accepted, if less enthusiastically than others, in the Sunni lineage known as the Righteous Caliphate. Tabari has been the backstop for the dominant Sunni perspective on Quran interpretation. He lauded the Quran, but as a text of divine origin that required human responsibility in its interpretation. There is no special advance knowledge given to human beings by birth. Each person has to learn the words of the Quran, memorize its chapters, reflect on its message, and then live by its signs. The Shiite perspective was not just an alternative way of reading the text. It was unacceptable, flawed in its assumptions, and injurious in its consequences.